Business Network.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Happy Passover. Happy Easter weekend to many of you. It's a congressional recess here in Washington, but the business of policy never stops. We've got a variety of topics to cover with you this morning. We start with one of the great headlines of the last week, the resignation of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius last week. Joining us to talk about that, Todd Tootin, a senior policy advisor in the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, where Todd focuses his career on legislative and regulatory matters related to health care. So, Todd, welcome back to the show. And let me start by asking, were you surprised by Sebelius' resignation, or was this inevitable?
Thanks, Kevin. No, I think pretty much everyone who wasn't in the Sebelius inner circle or the president's inner circle was surprised. The secretary was actually testifying before the Senate Finance Committee on the day this news became public. According to the White House, she'd had this conversation with the president back in March, but in fact waited until the end of the open enrollment season for the new health insurance exchanges to make it official.
Interesting. And talk to us a little bit about, I think the timing is very interesting, so talk to us a little bit about why now and what that means for the short-term future of the department.
So the timing really was tied to, again, the end of open enrollment, which officially ended on March 31st. But as you know, Kevin, the administration has been flexible in its interpretation of the Affordable Care Act and had
there
extended
are deadlines and there are
the
deadlines,
opportunity
right?
for, yeah, that's right, had extended the opportunity for certain individuals to enroll who faced a personal hardship or a technical challenge, which many people faced, frankly, navigating the exchange website, the federal website. She left at what was essentially the high water mark for enrollment. I mentioned the Senate Finance hearing. She announced that morning that 7.5 million individuals had enrolled in coverage through the exchanges. It's an interesting figure. It's higher than the target the administration set for itself, but it's an invalidated number because it doesn't tell you how many of those people previously had coverage and lost it, how many of those people actually paid premiums after signing up for coverage. So we're going to have to wait a little longer to see whether the numbers stick or are adjusted downward. The Congressional Budget Office put out a report this week saying it's sticking with its original estimate that 6 million people will gain coverage through the exchanges this year. So there's a little bit of a difference of opinion there.
Interesting. Well, so we go from Kathleen Sebelius, a fairly successful, well-regarded, moderate governor before taking the HHS position under President Obama, to a replacement in Sylvia Matthews Burwell, who was a little bit of a whiz kid under Clinton. Talk to us a little bit about Burwell's professional background and maybe compare and contrast it to Sebelius. Much like when a football coach is fired from the Redskins, they go in the opposite direction. Looks like they're going in the opposite direction here as well.
They are. That's a good analog, actually. I believe Ms. Burwell is 48 years old, so there's a generational difference there. You said whiz kid. I don't think that's an inappropriate term. She's been very successful in her public sector and private sector career to date. Excuse me. She spent time in the Clinton administration, as you mentioned, including senior positions at the Treasury Department. So she certainly has a head for numbers. She was then at the Walmart Foundation and spent a number of years at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So her career has spanned the public sector and the private nonprofit sector primarily. She was confirmed just a year ago unanimously by the Senate to serve as the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Again, you know, playing to her financial strengths. She was the administration's point person during the government shutdown. To the extent she could, she kept the trains running. So she is well regarded generally by Congress. She has proven herself an apt administrator in difficult political circumstances. But she'll still have to go through a confirmation process, and there's no lack of antipathy in Republican quarters for the Affordable Care Act, and she'll be a target for some of that.
Yeah, so she'll face the gauntlet. So let's break that down in two parts. Let's talk about some of the challenging questions that the Senate Republicans will get at her in a confirmation hearing, and then if confirmed as expected, and she gets the keys to the executive washroom, what sort of challenges does she face when she hits the ground there?
So take the first question first. I think the tough questions for her will be, how does the administration justify exempting large employers for a period of time from their responsibilities under the Affordable Care Act, while individuals are still subject to penalties? I think that'll be a point that will be hard-pressed by many Republicans. She'll also have to answer questions about the numbers that have been touted by the administration, and I suspect that those will be scrutinized quite carefully and, in fact, will be judged a bit inflated. Finally, she's going to have to oversee the next open enrollment period if she's confirmed, and health insurers are already trying to guesstimate what their premiums should be for the next plan year. They don't have a lot of data to go on, and the question is whether those premiums will be higher, noticeably higher, and
painfully
how they
higher
impact the individual and small business market. And, you know, politically, going into the midterm elections, Democrats are very worried about the prospects of anything involved in the Affordable Care Act going off the rails. And I do think there's going to be some conservative adjustment among insurers in their rate setting for the next plan year.
Interesting. Well, so she comes in, Burwell comes in and takes over. There'll obviously be some changes at the department. What will the general public notice, and what's it mean for the exchanges? The exchanges are going to be somewhat dormant for a few months before they crank back up for the next open enrollment period.
Yeah, she is, as I mentioned, viewed as a very capable administrator. Her background, sort of hands-on approach differ in that respect from outgoing Secretary Sebelius, who has really been at sort of the executive level as a former governor, a former insurance commissioner. I think the changes will be in the relationships. So Secretary Sebelius was very close to a number of the governors as one of their own formerly, likewise with the insurance commissioners. I think, for Ms. Burwell, it's going to be a bit of a challenge to build relationships with the insurance regulators, with the health insurers, and with the governors, all of whom are absolutely critical to the success of this health reform experiment going forward. And particularly with the governors, there are a number of states, as you know, Kevin, that have moved in the direction of seeking greater flexibility through the waiver process in exchange for expanding coverage under Medicaid. And even in some politically conservative states, that's an option that's been put on the table. How flexible Ms. Burwell is prepared to be and how capable she is in negotiating those types of arrangements will have a very dramatic impact on the expansion of coverage and the success of the Affordable Care Act in the near term.
Interesting. And talk about her legacy, how she'll be, Sebelius will be judged in the short term and the long term.
You know, I think she's well regarded generally, but unfortunately, perhaps a bit due to her more hands-off approach, will be judged by the absolute catastrophe involved in the rollout of the health insurance exchange, the federal exchange. The systems were not ready. The contractors were not held accountable to the federal government. It was a bit of a Keystone Cop exercise, and it was absolutely something you could anticipate. That said, there were tight deadlines and resource constraints, but I don't think she'll be forgiven for that. And, unfortunately for her, I think that's her primary legacy. I think from a more sympathetic perspective, she'll be viewed as a capable manager who kept a cool head, answered tough questions from Congress, or dodged tough questions from Congress in some cases, and kept the administration out of some political quagmires. But the failure of the launch of healthcare.gov is unfortunately for her just a key part of her legacy as secretary.
And if you had to predict what Burwell's margin of victory would be in the Senate on a confirmation vote?
I think there will be a handful of senators who make a political statement by voting against her, but So I wouldn't expect it to be unanimous, given the politically sensitive position to which she's been nominated. But it'll be a very, very healthy majority.
You think any of those people making a political statement and voting against her will be Democrats up for re-election in 2014, or all Republicans?
I'm not sure that's the way they would distance themselves politically from the Affordable Care Act. I think they're more likely to do what they've already been doing, which is introduce bills to make targeted corrections to the law and call out the administration when they think it's off course.
Very good. Todd, you want to hit people with your contact information and if they want to follow you, if you're on Twitter, let us know.
Absolutely. So it's ttuten, T-T-U-T-E-N, at pattenboggs.com. And direct dial is 202-457-5215.
Good. Well, if you want to follow us on Twitter, hit us at Capital Thinking. That's our show. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Kevin M. as in Michael underscore O'Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about voting rights in the District of Columbia here on Capital Thinking.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock.
Pat and Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Pat and Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Pat and Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Pat and Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we're going to turn our attention to the struggle for voting rights in the District of Columbia. Joining us is Kimberly Perry, who leads the group DC Votes, spearheading its strategy for national education and advocacy efforts as they pursue voting representation in the United States Congress for the almost 650,000 people who are resident in the District of Columbia. Before coming to DC Vote, Kimberly Perry led a series of local, national, and international education and lobbying efforts on policy changes affecting the lives of children and families. So Kimberly, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking, and maybe bring our listeners up to speed on what's going on, and tell us a little bit about why representation for DC residents is an issue that still hasn't been solved by Congress.
Thank you so much, Kevin, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate this time. Yeah, most Americans don't know that Americans that live right here in our nation's capital pay full federal taxes. We pay more our full share of federal taxes here. We fight and die in wars. We serve on juries. We fulfill all the obligations of citizenship, except we're denied voting representation in the Congress still. Again, we usually have to remind folks that there have been victories over time. You know, this has been a problem for 200 years. We do have the opportunity to vote for president and vice president. That happened in 1961. In 71, the Delegate Act was passed, and that gave us non-voting representation in the House of Representatives. And then in 73, we were able to pass the D.C. Home Rule Act, where Congress provided provided authority for the district to elect a mayor and a 13-member city council. There really has been no other progressive action in the voting rights movement since 1973, and so D.C. Votes been have been in place since 1998, working for the last 15 years, trying to continue to advance democracy for residents of the District of Columbia. The last thing I'll say about that is most Americans in the 50 states are shocked when I tell them that D.C. is also the only jurisdiction in the nation where all of our locally passed laws, all of our locally raised tax dollars for our local budget have to be approved by Congress before we can spend our money or before we can enact our laws. And so really what we want is just fair treatment and equality with every state across the nation.
Well, Kimberly, I know there's lots of interesting legal issues. You referenced the one about spending just there. And I know from time to time your organization takes a look at the various legal angles to this. You recently had a symposium in February organized by the College of William and Mary here in Washington, where you had some very leading legal figures talk about the various routes to DC enfranchisement. Talk to me a little bit about who came out to that symposium and maybe some of the things that, that were discussed there.
Absolutely. The College of William and Mary's Law School did an excellent job working to bring scholars and moderators from across the nation in to think thoughtfully about options for the district to take as we pursue options for representation or statehood for that matter. But, you know, sort of thinking about what will it take for us to secure equality and, again, be on par with the rest of our with the rest of Americans across the country. Headlining that symposium was Judge Ken Starr. He certainly was an influence to others who participated, like Heather Gerken at Yale Law, Jamie Raskin of the Washington College of Law, Richard Brafald from Columbia Law School, former Representative Tom Davis, Bob Bauer from Perkins Coie. So it was quite inspirational and wonderful validators to this issue of voting representation. I will say it was really intended to ignite the debate, and we believe the symposium was successful that way. Issues from looking at a constitutional amendment to guarantee the right to vote for all U.S. citizens, which of course would include the District of Columbia as well as the territories, was debated and discussed, and some have submitted papers to be published in the fall of the College of William and Mary's law journal. And so we're looking forward to seeing some of that. There was also analysis or kind of discussion on the feasibility of options like legislation for a vote in the House and or the Senate, legislation that would grant the district statehood, and looking at the pros and cons of both of those. And then finally, the symposium's shining light was the political discussion. What will it take on both sides of the aisle to see more political will to advance this issue on behalf of district residents? And if possible, are there opportunities to elevate this discussion to the international stage? And what would that look like for the United States being the beacon of democracy in the world, shining a light on its vulnerable point, which is, as you mentioned, nearly 650,000 American citizens still not having equal voting rights.
Very good. Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about what's next. I'm wondering about, obviously, we're in an election year, so Congress is going to have perhaps a more limited agenda than they do in the off years. What sort of vehicles exist for getting something like this moving in the legislature, and who might be your champions outside of the D.C.'s own delegate?
And we're still analyzing that. We've been working very closely with Patton Boggs. One of the things I think that has really helped, we began a series of looking at some renewed relationships on Capitol Hill. As you know, we've had so many new members come into the Congress who are not aware of this issue at all. Clearly, it doesn't have an impact on their home districts or home states, and so they are learning it for the first time. Whether they serve on an oversight committee, financial services appropriations, they are remotely sort of interested in these issues. So we've taken a lot of time to visit members on both sides of the aisle to really discuss this inequality and to begin to look for potential champions to welcome into the fold to help us continue that thinking about legislative options that could produce some clear results for the District of Columbia. I also want to say, you know, part of the follow-up of the symposium was sharing some of that debate with staff members and with members on the Hill. So since the symposium happened February 21st, you know, we've been meeting constantly week after week with members' offices talking about what occurred at that symposium, and the result of that is, I would say, two nice handfuls of members of both Republicans and Democrats willing to sit down at the table with us to continue that discussion on what routes we might want to take in the future, but to think through a solution, a permanent solution for the District of Columbia. The last thing I'll say ahead for us is we have moved ahead on other legislative fronts, like many other groups on many other issues across the country. Congress is often stalled and cannot take affirmative action to advance issues, so a lot of folks have gone back to look at what can be done at the state or local level. So we have worked over the last couple of years to pass the local budget autonomy law that would essentially solve or resolve this issue of D.C.'s budget having to go before the Congress every year in an affirmative fashion for approval. And so that law locally has been passed and is being implemented in preparation for the 2015 fiscal year budget for D.C. We're also adding new supporters every day. We understand that members on the Hill will not act unless their constituents tell them to do so. So over the last year, we've added 15,000 new supporters to this movement. 9,000 of them live in the 50 states. So we need to see that support from other Americans, and so we're gaining ground.
Interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about if people want to get involved at the grassroots level, helping out, maybe give us a sense of how they can do that.
We would love for folks to join us. If you go to dcvote.org, there are several ways for individuals to get involved. Policy at the local level, as it relates to our budget, there are active events going on right now supporting us, petitions to assure that this new budget law is enforced or implemented and enforced with the utmost integrity. We also have social events that happen throughout the city to engage new residents who come in, and they actually don't know that once they go to change their registration to vote, they are losing their ability to vote in federal elections. So we have a series of happy hours, other social events where we get to informally educate new residents to the city. So if folks go to dcvote.org, we'd love to have you sign our petition, sign up, join our network, become a donor, and attend and participate in any one of these policy or social activities that happen throughout the year.
Very good. All right, Kimberly Perry from DC Votes. We're going to take a break and come back right after this with more Capital Thinking.
Become our friend.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We are joined by two regulars here on the show. Deborah Lodge, who's been a guest host on the show and often comes to talk to us about IP issues, and Melanie Gates, who's part of the information security team here at the firm. We're going to spend some time talking about privacy and data security, and also about this heartbleed problem you hear a lot about in the news. So, Mel, let's start with you. Welcome back to the show. I know you had a first career in the data security field before you went to law school. You're certified as a privacy professional, and so maybe explain to us. I know when I get an email from you, it even has in your signature block the initial CIPP/US. So tell us a little bit about what it means to be a privacy professional, and then lead into what this heartbleed sort of security threat is in our internet.
Well, thanks, Kevin. It's always great to be here. The certifications are actually managed from an organization called the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and the IAPP is really the leading global organization on privacy issues. And so when you see that certification, what it tells you is that the person you're working with has demonstrated a baseline of understanding about privacy law and data security practices and maintains education around those kinds of things. So that's what that's all about. But let's talk about Heartbleed, because first, what a great name. You got to love the names that we come up with for these things. And it's been all over the news in the last week or two. But what Heartbleed is all about is it's a code defect. It's a problem in the software for something called OpenSSL. Now, SSL is the way encryption is applied between your browser when you're on the internet and the web server you're talking to. That little lock that we've always told people to look for says you're using SSL. Now, some organizations use this software called OpenSSL, and apparently for about 2 years, there's been a code defect in place. It was just announced a week or so ago that would, under certain circumstances, allow someone to come and try and get information from the web server and ultimately be able to get those encryption keys. And what happens if I'm allowed to get your encryption keys, then I can now eavesdrop and look at the information going across the internet that we thought was private. So kind of a scary bug there.
Interesting. Okay, so maybe compare and contrast for us the size of the problem. In December, there was a lot of concern, consternation nationwide about everybody who shopped at Target and had their information potentially breached there when they scanned their credit card. Compare and contrast Heartbleed to that situation for us.
Well, the first really important thing to understand about Heartbleed is it's not a breach, it's a vulnerability. And what a vulnerability means is we know there's a problem, we know there's a code defect, it needs to be fixed, but it doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's taken advantage of it yet. So what's important is that organizations that run web servers have a strong vulnerability response program in place so that as soon as one of these things comes out, they can react to it very quickly, protect themselves, and then tell their customers, if they're concerned at all, that data may have been exposed. So you may be getting information from web service providers that you work with that says, change your password. If you get a message that says, change your password, first off, don't click on emails that say that, because this also creates a real opening for phishing emails, people who come and try to convince you that you should tell them your password. Don't do that, but if you get an email that says, I'm from a website that you use, we're concerned that your data may have been exposed, you need to change your password, go over to that website directly, use a bookmark you already have, and go ahead and take action there. There have been some breach reports related to Heartbleed. The most notable one that's come out just in the past few days is the Canada Revenue Agency. So their taxing authority actually shut down their tax website and extended their tax filing deadline because they realized that not only did they have the vulnerability, but they had been attacked using Heartbleed. And in fact, just yesterday, they announced that they've arrested a 19-year-old in Canada who was taking advantage of the bug.
Interesting. Well, Deborah, let me get you involved here and ask, what can we do to prevent this something like this from happening in the future?
Yeah, great question, Kevin. And Mel, I really appreciate your very practical perspective on that. One problem with the Heartbleed is that it really came from open source code, which means that, you know, it's free for everyone, you know, the code programmers, to take a look at it and to use it. So as a result, no one's spending a lot of money on testing it. The theory is that, you know, people who are using it will report the bugs and be really interested in making it secure, but that didn't happen here, and that's really pretty amazing.
Mel, did you have anything to add on that?
You know, from a data security perspective, as Deborah mentioned, upfront testing is just key. There's something we call privacy by design, and that means thinking about the kind of information you might be handling and doing specific testing for that upfront. And then working with vendors, you know, one of the interesting things that's come out, as Deborah mentioned, OpenSSL is open source code. A lot of organizations didn't even realize they were using it until this bug came along. And so understanding the software you have in place and being prepared, again, to react when one of these kinds of things come up is just critical.
Interesting. Well, let's transition and talk a little bit about the legal ramifications of some of this, which is, oftentimes in technology in particular, it's hard for enforcement regimes to catch up to technological innovation. Who's actually in charge of protecting me from problems like this in the privacy and data security arena?
Great question, Kevin. And, you know, there are really two regimens that we follow here. One, of course, is that nearly every state and the District of Columbia has a breach notification law, and that kicks in if, as Mel mentioned, you know, there really has been a breach that's been detected. But also, the big cop on the federal beat is the Federal Trade Commission in the privacy area. And there have been some recent developments in that area that I would also like to discuss, because they're significant for anyone who has privacy systems or provides privacy protections to consumer data.
Gotcha. Melanie, anything to add on that?
Well, you know, the state breach notification laws that Deborah mentioned are something to keep in mind. Just last week, Kentucky became the 47th state to have a breach notification law in place. But every state is just a little bit different. And some of them, including the new law in Kentucky, allow the organization that experienced the breach to do an analysis and decide whether they reasonably believe that there might be a problem for identity theft or fraud. The concern there is sometimes organizations are willing to accept a little bit more risk than individuals might, because, of course, it's embarrassing when you have to notify your customers that you've lost their data.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is embarrassing. Makes you not want to go back there. Well, so you talk about Kentucky. Deborah, let me ask you, what about the federal side of the equation?
Well, on the federal side, we still do not have a federal data breach notification law. For years, Congress has been debating what form such a law should take, and I keep expecting that one will be passed. Kevin, I'm sure that you track things like that on the legislative side. But the FTC, as I mentioned, is really the big cop on the federal beat right now, and that the agency has brought many privacy-related cases and has been very active in this area.
Interesting. So that the FTC is not who I really think of as the lead player on things like this. I suspect a lot of folks think similarly. So why is it the FTC is sort of the first among regulatory equals here?
Well, two things. Because one is that our federal system is really sector specific. As I'm sure that, you've noted the HIPAA notices that, come under, the HHS jurisdiction, but the FTC has the general authority, to move and regulate in the area of unfair and deceptive practices. And that, of course, pertains to a lot of consumer data that is moving to make purchases and on the internet. And recently, the FTC just obtained a significant win in a New Jersey case, which relates to a case that the FTC brought against Wyndham Hotels and Resorts.
Well, why don't you give us a little more in-depth understanding of what happened in that Wyndham case?
In the Wyndham case, the FTC had brought an action, a federal court action, challenging certain Wyndham alleged deficiencies as both unfair and deceptive acts and practices. And as I'm sure you know, the FTC has a very broad statute mandate which allows it to challenge unfair and deceptive acts and practices. And Wyndham said, wait, that's not fair to us, because first, the FTC's unfairness power should not extend to the data security area. And second, the FTC, said Wyndham, had failed to give sufficient guidance or prior notice of what it would deem to be acceptable standards in the privacy area. And the court rejected those arguments. Now, this is a motion to dismiss, so the FTC still has to prove its case, but it is allowing the FTC case to go forward.
So one of the maybe gray areas in the law is that it seems like the Congress has, you mentioned, Congress hasn't passed the data breach law in the past, but they have filled in some of the gray areas in the financial services industry, where they regulate some privacy practices under Graham, Leach, Bliley, and then under what's known as COPPA, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, they've regulated some things that involve our children's access to the internet. But what does Wyndham say about the scope and potential limit of FTC authority where Congress is silent?
Well, that's exactly one of the big issues, because Wyndham attacked the FTC's ability to challenge data security practices as unfair acts and practices if they were deficient. Wyndham had said that the FTC lacked jurisdiction over such practices, and it referred to certain statements that the FTC had made about, you know, limited authority that he had in the area. But the FTC claimed that its unfairness jurisdiction extended to areas where it was likely to cause substantial injury to consumers, such as this, and consumers couldn't help themselves to avoid that, then the court found that the FTC really did have that authority to proceed.
Mel and Deborah, let me ask you, what's the underlying big picture significance of this Wyndham case, what it means for the future? Deborah, you first.
Well, I think it's huge because really it is a message. It gives a message to consumers and companies that they really need to assess their privacy practices and pay attention to breaches that they may have and also to notices that they may get of deficiencies.
Mel, what do you think?
Well, you know, one of the things that these FTC cases really point up is on the company or service provider side, how critical it is to have that proactive information security program in place. In addition to Wyndham, there's one other similar case where an organization has challenged the FTC's authority, and that's from an organization called LabMD. Now, their challenge is a little bit different. They're saying that the FTC shouldn't have authority to layer more regulation on top of the regulations they already experience under HIPAA since they were a healthcare organization. Now, I said were. Really interesting thing going on there is they experienced some significant data breaches, and because of some of these enforcement actions, they actually wound down their operations some time ago, but the litigation is still underway. Wyndham also experienced specific security breaches. In that case, a large number of payment cards, credit card numbers, were exposed and showed up in Eastern Europe, Russian hackers, that kind of thing, the places that we see a lot of payment cards go to. So notable thing in both these cases, they're challenging the FTC's authority, but they didn't have the right kind of information security program in place, clearly, since they had these kinds of lax controls that allowed these things to happen.
Gotcha. Deborah, did you have anything to respond to Mel on there?
Well, I totally agree with her. And the other thing is that all of these cases really are signals to companies who are handling personal information of consumers that they have to be careful about what they're saying and live up to whatever they're saying. And indeed, the FTC has just taken other actions to remind companies of their obligations. And many of these, of course, come under the FTC's deceptive acts and practices prong because they're sort of basic FTC law. You know, the FTC expects companies to live up to the promises they're making to consumers.
Yes, that would be a good thing. Well, are there other warnings and cases out there? I know I saw something in passing about warning regarding Facebook.
Recently, the FTC sent a letter to both Facebook and WhatsApp. As you probably know, WhatsApp is the smartphone messenger app that the FTC is about to acquire. And apparently, the WhatsApp privacy policy has certain restrictions and limitations in it that are more narrow than what the Facebook privacy policy is. And the FTC's letter was really a reminder to the companies that they need to make sure that Facebook, after the acquisition, lives up to the promises that WhatsApp had made to its consumer base.
Okay. I'm sure it's got to be hard to keep track of what companies are making promises to what consumers.
And you know what? That's a recurring theme in the FTC area. Recently, Fandango and Credit Karma both ran into similar issues where the FTC charged that they had apps that made certain promises to consumers and weren't followed, and also apps where the consumers needed to be given additional information and options to either opt in to certain protections or opt out of them. And in fact, I'm sure, Kevin, you may have the Flashlight app on your smartphone.
I do.
Well, they just entered into an agreement with the FTC to ensure that they would give clearer notifications to consumers, including what are called just-in-time disclosures, so that consumers can see right away at the time of, you know, the collection of the information or right before it, that what the collection's going to be, and have the opportunity to either opt into it or opt out.
So, Mel and Deborah, I know you guys counsel a lot of corporations on these rules, and we've covered a lot of ground. I want to start with Mel and ask, Mel, maybe summarize for me the three or four key things that the Wyndham case and all these other items we've talked about are crystallizing in the mind as sort of what are responsible actions for companies to take to protect themselves going forward.
Well, sure. There are a couple of things that companies need to do, and the first one is to think proactively. In terms of vulnerabilities and issues like Heartbleed and even the kinds of security controls issues that the FTC has gone after companies for, it's about understanding the assets and the technology you have and then putting the processes in place to continuously monitor and recognize security issues and take care of those things before you get attacked, rather than having to clean the mess up later. So that asset management and vigilance is a key piece. Another piece is what we talked about before with privacy by design. And the idea there is when you're building a new product or service, to consciously think about what data are we collecting from consumers, what are we going to do with it, what kinds of promises are we going to make, and then again, build processes into your business to carry through on those things. One of the big issues that you see in organizations is that their policy folks, maybe the people in their legal or compliance group, are thinking one thing and they write a privacy policy that makes a promise to consumers, but then developers go off and do something different from a technology perspective and are collecting data, and these two things aren't matching up. So a lot of it is about putting those, again, business processes in place to make sure all of those stakeholders are talking up front so consumers understand what you're doing.
Deborah, sort of same question. What are the key takeaways for corporations as they plan for the future?
I have to reiterate what Mel said, because it is so critical for the company to know what its practices are and to disclose those clearly to consumers. Because what we have seen time and time again are instances where the privacy policy says one thing, and the actual practices are totally different, and the business people do not know what the technical part is doing. So it's really critical for there to be communication, and as Mel said, to design the apps, design the capabilities with privacy in mind, and to make sure consumers are informed of those capabilities, and that the consumer is giving the choice where personal data is being collected, about whether to share it and to consent to the uses. So that's critical.
Very interesting. Well, let me ask you, we talked a lot about Heartbleed and whatnot. What do you suspect, Mel, falling back on your first career, where do you suspect we'll see the next sort of target Heartbleed type situation come out of? What should we prepare ourselves for as consumers or be worried about?
Well, I think this emphasis on encryption is probably a critical piece. You know, organizations and consumers, we put so much trust into encryption processes, and we think of it as a panacea. If we've learned anything from Heartbleed, we ought to be learning, hey, that helps us, but it's not going to take care of every situation, and it can have a flaw too. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised for us to see more software defects in the encryption space since we've become so dependent on it. But as consumers, you know, we can still remember there's a lot that we can do here. We can be careful with our information. We can be careful about which emails we respond to or how we manage going to websites. And then we can also, as consumers, remind companies that privacy is important to us and that we're willing to take our business elsewhere. And, you know, we can do a lot of things on the public policy side, but that consumer pressure is what's really going to cause companies to be more proactive about these things.
Gotcha. And, Deborah, anything to add to that in conclusion?
Well, I agree with that. And I guess the last thing I would say is companies need to pay attention to their consumers and what happens. And if they do suffer breaches or other issues, to take action right away to correct it and to make sure that, you know, they're doing whatever's required reasonably under the law.
Gotcha. Well, Mel, give everyone your contact email or Twitter if they'd like to follow you, and then we'll have Deborah do the same.
Well, you can reach me through email at mgates@pattenbogs.com.
All right. Deborah?
And I'm very similar. I am D Lodge, L-O-D-G-E, like a hotel, @pattenbogs.com. And
all
follow
right.
You all the time, Kevin.
Well, that's good to know somebody does. That's going to do it for this week's Capital Thinking. We hope everyone has a blessed Passover or Easter, and we'll be back next week with another show about the intersection between politics, business, and the law. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.